Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 150, which is the third and final part of this guest series looking at paleo art in popular culture. If you've listened through already, then you will have heard all about representations of dinosaurs through time, from their first models at the Great Exhibition through to Jurassic World and Prehistoric Planet today. So if you've not yet listened, then that's the obvious place for you to start. In this episode, the University of Bristol's paleo media specialist Vicky Cools tells Suresh Singh all about the need for films and documentaries to be able to substantiate their claims. How do we know whether or not the scenes they depict are based on paleontological facts? Then the series ends by stepping back and considering what the point of all this science communication is anyway. The thing that I've loved about hosting this guest interview is that the questions asked aren't those that I would have come up with myself. The conversation is taken in different directions and we get different viewpoints and expertise. So once again, I'll reiterate that the floor is open for anyone who wants to use the PaleoCast platform to tell a story of paleontological research. So please do get in touch if it's of interest. As for 2023 coming along, I've recorded our next episode, which will be on a really rare group of animals in the fossil record, and will be released to coincide with a pretty big press release. We're also in discussions to livestream a couple of conferences this year, and I'm collecting prizes for the next paleo art competition. A lot of these things are only possible because of the donations that we get from our Patreon subscribers, so thanks to you all, and I'll be releasing you a video episode in a couple of days, so look out for that. And as always, the images and videos that accompany this episode are available on our website, and any likes, shares, or comments on social media are always appreciated. Please feel free to get in touch if there are any subjects or pieces of research that you'd really like to see as a future interview. And until then, I hope you enjoy this episode.
With modern paleomedia, this has led, I don't know if it's direct follow on because of things like Fantasia, but there's a very big emphasis on substantiating your art, your representations. Prehistoric Planet went, it's visually stunning. And it has a whole host of paleontological advisors, some of them, based here at Bristol, just to put it out there. But also, from across the globe. And they put a lot of emphasis on the idea that the stories they're showing, these clips, these animations of these different dinosaurs, are based on scientific fact. Of course, we know that things that we think may be fact today, future evidence may show actually it's slightly different. It's not quite like that. Case in point being, Jurassic Park back in 93, of course, scaly dinosaurs, especially looking at the velociraptors, now we know actually much more likely to be very heavily feathered a lot more like a bird than like a sort of scary reptilian monster.
Yes, I think there is that difference. And I think as well, there is the sense that once you have set this, there is this question that still comes up, whether it's Fantasia or whether it's Jurassic Park, there is an element of the audience is going to say, how do you know? And I think the same criticism that was leveled at Walking with Dinosaurs, which we would hold up to be a great, again, another game changer, but a lot of the criticism that leveled at that, and I have heard the same criticism leveled at Prehistoric Planet, isn't that it's wrong, it's genuinely, how do we know? Whereas if you take The Last Day of the Dinosaurs, for example, the documentary on the BBC with David Attenborough, it's very clearly showing you why they thought that was the case.
They went through a lot of, there's a lot of emphasis on how they actually worked out that this is what happened, and they show a great deal of the science in the show.
Yes.
Beforehand. I believe it has like Sir David going around talking to the different paleontologists involved in different aspects of the study. So it's a much heavier emphasis on the science, certainly. Yeah.
Yes, and it in that show he goes and looks at the fossils and the site and so on. But I think there was a sense with, as some of you know, in my day job, I work in natural history documentary. And I had a very interesting comment on prehistoric world from a friend who is a very well-established and well-known and respected natural history producer. And he made the point that he said, if you haven't seen the series, it's very much structurally like Walking with Dinosaurs. The episodes are slightly longer, I think they're 40 minutes, but you basically just get put in this world and watch these animals.
Each by sort of biome.
Yes. And it's themed by habitat or bio. But there is no sense of how we know this. It's just presented. So, for example, I mentioned it earlier, you see a male T-Rex swimming with his three chicks, if you like, from the mainland to an island. The reason given as there was a big...
continental inland seaway in
yes America. But there was a carcass, if you like, on the island that he wanted to feed on. That was why he was. Now the argument then became, well, why the male? Now we know that there are situations where birds will, isn't it the ostrich, I could be wrong, where the male raises the chicks and defends them. My ornithology is a bit rusty, but...
I'm afraid I'll defer to your ornithology on this one.
I'd be perfectly happy for people to contradict me on that. But a lot of the questions became, well, you've speculated on that without saying why you think that was the case. Now, this friend, as I said, the other comment he made, which I thought was interesting, was he said it was, to him, used to working in and watching natural history shows, said it was almost a victim of its own success. Because the CGI in Prehistoric Planet was superb. There's been nothing like it. It was brilliant. But he said what it did for him was, after a while, because it was so good, he bought into it. And then it was like watching a natural history show. And watching it as a natural history show, it had some weaknesses. And the weaknesses are nothing to do with the paleontology or the CGI. It was just to do with the way the narrative worked.
So the actual storytelling itself.
Storytelling, if you like. There was no narrative going through the whole episode. It was a series of vignettes of creatures in certain places, which I know worked for a lot of viewers. But what was interesting, that was a case where the CGI was so good that you stopped even thinking it was CGI and you bought into, this is as real as watching lions chasing wildebeest or you know, eagles trying to catch things. And I thought that was an interesting observation. Personally, I was a bit disappointed that I wanted to know about the science. I was prepared to then go and find out.
So they have these little featurettes on YouTube.
But they're on YouTube. Yeah. So to be perfectly honest, I haven't yet organised myself to go get onto YouTube, find them and watch them. Something that the BBC did and still does well with a lot of natural history shows, and I honestly thought they were going to do this with Prehistoric Planet, was to have the show, and at the end, what they'll often do is put 10 minutes maybe at the end, what they call the making of or behind the scenes. Mm. And my thinking was, oh, what they'll do is the show, like they did with Walking with Dinosaurs, and then put that as how we know. But they didn't do this. And so to make that step, to assume your viewer was going to... And it wasn't that clear at the end when David stood and said, you know, if you've enjoyed this. And I must admit, I missed it. I had to ask somebody to assume then that your viewer was then going to go away, go onto a different medium, find YouTube, find the clips and watch them, detracted from...
But isn't this, isn't that kind of what Walking with Dinosaurs did? Like, yes. It didn't have a behind-the-scenes sort of thing. I mean, I think they do have something now on like the DVD download. You can there's a making of feature, like a feature documentary included. Yes. But at the time, I don't think that when it aired on the BBC that it had any making of stuff. So is it maybe a case that our expectations are perhaps because Prehistoric Planet was so good in terms of CGI, it looked, like you say, it looked real. Mm. We kind of expected more of it.
I don't know whether we expected more. I think the questions, I mean, we've all those of you who've seen it and are paleontologists, I've already got friends who've seen it who aren't paleontologists but are asking questions. And I was getting the same sort of questions as, well, how do they know that?
Hmm.
And I think had there been a more accessible, I'm not saying we necessarily have constructed the shows differently, but had there been a more accessible, well, this is how we know that, or this is why we speculate that the male T-Rex looked after the chicks, or this is how we know this happened. In The Last Day of the Dinosaurs, they had the scene on the beach, and all the animals that they showed by CGI on that beach were based on fossils that they'd found on the site, and they showed that's what, and then they reconstructed the last day. Now, this might sound like a picky criticism, if you like, but I just thought it was an interesting take on a new and groundbreaking show, that the criticisms that have been levelled at Walking with Dinosaurs, which was how do we know this, hadn't been quite taken on board in the same way. We were almost repeating the same
thing. It was the same sort of thing, which, again, I think it's funny how it keeps going back to that whole thing of, like, when you portray these animals in, you know, in their environment, living out their lives like this, be it either on the TV screen or in a painting, it's that, that question of how do we know, and it keeps coming back. I mean, it's natural that it would be. It's a natural curiosity sort of to ask these questions. But I think that comes back to the whole thing. If you get it wrong, then that looms large in the popular culture for a very long time. Again, 30 years since Jurassic Park, and people are still complaining about feathered dinosaurs. And I think, yeah, maybe it's because Prehistoric Planet has a global audience instantly right now.
Yes.
That there's a lot greater expectation on it about, because, I mean, at the time with Walking with Dinosaurs, obviously there were questions about how do we know, but it didn't seem to be so, like, it didn't seem so pressing.
No, it didn't. And we didn't have social media. True. We didn't have the channels, if you like, for everybody to discuss this at length and sometimes heatedly, as you said. So I think there was a different in terms of the way the medium it was presented. It came onto BBC. If it had been shown overseas, it wouldn't have been shown at the same time, whereas the release of Prehistoric Planet more or less happened everywhere at the same time, so everybody could argue about it endlessly on social media. So I think that might be quite a factor in how the reception worked out.
But do you think that it's kind of funny, because in this year we've had Prehistoric Planet, perhaps the most realistic representation of dinosaurs in paleomedia that we've ever had. And then on the other hand, you've got, so that's you know, documentary filmmaking. And then on the other hand, you've got Jurassic World Dominion, and you've got the big Hollywood blockbuster, you know, all the bells and whistles of Hollywood going at it. And you've got these movie monsters now. Obviously, I think there are more dinosaurs in Jurassic World Dominion, in that one, like different species of dinosaur in that film, than in any other of the Jurassic World or Jurassic Park movies. But it seems to be, it's got like a mix. It has got feathered dinosaurs, but it also just goes wholeheartedly in with the monsterized dinosaurs as well. I mean, the Giganotosaurus, the Velociraptors, they've just given up in that one with the feathers on Velociraptor, and it's kind of a clash of two ideas in one movie.
Yes, and we see, of course, the even in Jurassic World, the interesting thing I thought in that was, because they wanted the monster dinosaurs, the story lets them create them artificially by gene manipulation. I find personally that fascinating, because if you've read the original book of Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton, to me, that book is not about dinosaurs. That book is about the morality of genetic manipulation.
I mean, it's sort of like a modern-day Frankenstein.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good analogy. And so the film then picks up on the dinosaurs and makes that the story. And the Jurassic World angle was to, because they even discuss this in the film, and they pick it up in the two sequels, that, you know, these dinosaurs weren't scary enough for the public, so they genetically engineer something that's more scary. So we're back to that word I've used, is monsterization, and it comes through all the way through the three films, I think.
Hmm. Do you think that, I mean, again, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't watched the film, but I'll give you a moment just to skip ahead. Okay. So do you think there's any symbolism perhaps in the Therizinosaur killing the feathered, you know, herbivorous theropod dinosaur, kind of, you know, one of those dinosaurs that we didn't know about? Well, it was certainly not big in amongst the general public back in the 90s, certainly. It's kind of more representative of what we think of dinosaurs now, you know, that bird link, unique animals. Do you think there's something symbolic about it being the one to help take down the big bad of Giganotosaurus, you know, the sort of monsterized, you know, the most evil dinosaur that ever lived, to call it?
Yes. Well, what I thought was curious was, I think that was an interesting point, and I think I could be really cynical here and say this was a sop to the people who made a fuss about the velociraptors and the feathers and so on. I also thought it was interesting that they chose that particular dinosaur because of the scythe claws.
Hmm.
That visually, if you look at that, with or without its feathers, it's got, as you will know, these massive claws, which, as I understand it, they thought were used to actually just pull at the vegetation. But those claws look like quite impressive weapons. And I wondered if that particular, I like the idea of the, as you say, the sort of innocent herbivore taking down the big bad villain. But I wonder if that's why they chose that dinosaur rather than one of the other herbivores to do that, because it could be bipedal, so it could stand up and it had those claws. It is just a speculation on my part, but I think there is maybe something in that. Maybe they were beginning to think, actually, we need to move away from, you know, the big back carnivore.
We can't have T-Rex coming in to save the day again.
Again.
Yeah.
As it has done so many times before. And I think there is an element in there of this idea of they went down the route with the Jurassic World franchise of the genetic manipulation deliberately to make more scary monsters. And they even discuss this in various scenes in the film.
So I think one thing that keeps coming up again and again is that you have the ideas and the sort of themes of the day seeping into these representations. And obviously that's going to be more so in a Hollywood film, like in a entertainment film. And that certainly seems to be the case in the Jurassic World franchise and Jurassic Park franchise. As you say, it's about sort of playing God, perhaps, you know, science run amok, you know, but the ethics of doing this, should we use it, can we control it, do we even know what we're letting ourselves in for? Well, the Jurassic World franchise, I think it's interesting because it talks a lot about this whole idea of consumerism. And like you say, we need a bigger, obviously I think the line's like, we need a bigger, badder, scarier, yes, more teeth.
Yeah.
And so isn't that seems to be one of the things, of course, now with at the time of recording, sort of a cost of living crisis, and this whole idea of companies evil businessmen who are trying to just enrich themselves at the expense of all of us, breaking the laws and all that, and it seems to come through in, well, certainly the last one in Jurassic World Dominion. Again, spoiler alert. So the they have a return of Dodson.
Yes.
Dodson, who was in the first film, in the Jurassic Park film, and he's now back as a sort of, what's his name? Tim Cook. He's kind of like a Tim Cook / Steve Jobs' character.
Yes.
He's like this sort of, I don't know, he's kind of, this slick sort of tech businessman. I thought he was a bit of an idiot, but that's how he is given that image of a sort of like one of these tech bosses that you would see today. And of course he's got evil plans to take over, to make a lot of money and maybe take over the world. Yeah. So do you think that it's using dinosaurs, not just for education, as, you know, back when they were first portrayed in Paleomedia, but now it's also about just speaking to us generally, that they're a messenger for a lot more nowadays.
I think that's the case, but I think what we're now reaching is a whole area in, if you like, film theory, of how, of which is a fascinating subject. And there are people more qualified than me to speak of it, but you can often look at a film and it can equate or to or represent the sort of social and cultural structure of its time and the issues of its time. And that's a fascinating area. I can recommend some very good textbooks.
Oh, well, maybe we'll come back to that another time, so another episode.
That's the sort of thing you're talking about. And I think that can happen. The only other thing worth bearing in mind is when you're looking at those sort of issues, is rather like I kept mentioning the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. If the film was released in 1940, all the preparation would have been done before then. Mm. And obviously with Jurassic World Dominion, that animation story writing and so on has been going on for years, culminating in the release this summer. And I know it was delayed to some extent by COVID, but it's a question of not only just looking at what's happening now, but look at what was going on in the previous few years when those story decisions were being made or the animation was being created. So there is that time shift that has to be taken into account as well.
I think, yeah, it's an interesting to see how these different types of paleomedia have portrayed dinosaurs. You know, you've got so many different sort of variants on the portrayal. So like you say, with Prehistoric Planet and The Day the Dinosaurs Died, it's very much more taking a more, you know, it's a documentary. You've got the science in there to varying degrees. You know, it's there one way or another. And then you've got the Hollywood blockbuster, you know, just no holds barred sort of fun and enjoyment. And at the end of the day, isn't that kind of the point of paleomedia? It's to engage. So if you can attract that engagement, then isn't the, you know, isn't it kind of like once you pull people into the story, into the, you know, into the topics of dinosaurs and prehistoric animals, does it help then just to engage them and not really educate them too much and expect them to, you know, get hooked and then go out and find the science themselves?
There is an argument for that.
Because doesn't that seem to be the way, I mean, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that this is the case in a lot of natural history filmmaking nowadays, that it's to try and hook people into stories. Hook people into the stories, and then, you know, sort of, you can drop bits of science in there as well. Educate them, you know, with a little bit, and then afterwards it's on, you know, it's kind of on them to go and find out more.
Very much so. And I think the other thing it does is it does inspire people to go into science. I know of paleontologists who quite openly say, I became a paleontologist because I saw Fantasia or because I saw Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
What's depressing for me at my age is I know people who have said to me, I became a biologist because I saw this show that I might have worked on a while ago, shall we say, as a child. It's a bit unnerving for me to come into a university and be told that a show I was series writer on, which doesn't seem to me that long ago, I'm now talking to postgrads who say, oh, yes, I became a biologist because I saw that show. But that's happened several times. And I think that was even one of the arguments way back in Cope's time, Osborne in particular. You know, if we can get people interested, then we've got them engaged. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, you know, you know people who might well say, oh, well, I saw Jurassic Park and fell in love with dinosaurs, and they're now practicing paleontologists. So again, it's six of one and half a dozen of the other, as we
I was going to say, is it here. Kind of vindication of Cope and, you know,
yes, I think it's a reflection of that argument that started back then is still an argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's still going. I mean, even if so again, we've been using dinosaurs as the message of science for this one, but it's that whole thing of, you know, scientific communication, getting the science from the scientists and out into the broader public domain. You know, it's no good us doing this research if we can't, you know, tell people about it. And I think that's certainly become a lot more pressing to all of us, given, well, the coronavirus pandemic, of course, the whole thing about fake news with the virus and with the misinformation going around about the vaccines, the confusion around messaging and all that. So I think that the whole idea of what happens if we, the scientists get it wrong, or they have to, we don't quite know everything, so we have to infer other things, and then later on it turns out that's, not right. It's that whole idea of trust in science, perhaps.
Yes, but I think paleontology is a particularly good example for that, because as we've seen, and paleontologists amongst you know very well, it's a science where one discovery can turn the entire thing on its head. So one more fossil. If somebody went out tomorrow and dug up a T-Rex that was clearly dated to be, say, 50 million years old, then the whole thing unravels. But what I'm saying is that paleontology, I think, is a science that's attractive for that reason, because it's very easy for a non-scientist to grasp that if you find a new discovery, you have to change your theories to fit the new evidence. And that's what a lot of people find difficult. So we're on a slightly different subject with coronavirus. It was initially thought to be transmitted by touch and surface. So everybody was frantically wearing gloves and sanitizing hands and work surfaces everywhere. Yeah. And then it was later discovered with further research, of course, to be airborne. But I think with paleontology, it's just easier in some ways to visualize that if, rather like, as I said earlier, it appears on the national news, a new dinosaur species has been found, some more footprints have been found. In this case of the news released today, that they think there might be another asteroid strike that would have compounded the first one. And the curiosity is engaged, and the understanding of how science works and how science then changes its thinking to fit with the evidence. And it's a huge idea to put across, and as we saw with the epidemic, it can go horribly wrong. But that's my profound thinking on the nature of paleontology.
Maybe we strayed a bit off topic dinosaurs.
I think back to the idea of dinosaurs as ambassadors for science is how cool people think they are, and therefore they're curious about.
Excellent. I mean, it certainly was the case for me. I'm sure it's certainly the case for many listeners as well. So, Vicky, I think I've got just a few more questions to wrap up. But my first question is, in your opinion, what would be your... Okay, simple question. What's your favourite bit of paleo art or paleo media?
Oh, it's a difficult one because I've met so much and come across so much. I think I have a really soft spot for Gertie the dinosaur.
Yeah.
it's opposite to everything we know about, like, the big bad T-Rex. I mean, Gertie is...
It's a lighthearted cartoon.
It's a lighthearted, and she's almost like a pet. So I think for me, in terms of a favourite bit, I think it would be that.
Okay. My final question then, Vicky, is what would you say is your biggest takeaway message from the research, from your PhD research? What's been the most impactful to you?
I think it's the fact that, to some extent, I sort of knew this from my background in art history and the study of visual culture, but it's something that I get quite boring on the subject with what I call real paleontologists, is that every image that you look at has got a backstory, if you like. There's an influence is on it that you don't see in the image. You cannot take an image in itself as it. So the sorts of influences might be quite subtle, might be less subtle, but every image is more than just the final result. And this is why I was so interested, which takes me back to your original question. This is why I was so interested in doing this in, if you like, paleontology, was because of that, and because of the use of paleontology of artistic, for want of a better word, images to explore their own science.
Brilliant.
It was a bit waffly, but I think you got it.
Oh, no, that was it. Yeah,
I need a drink.
one more question.
Yes, okay.
Okay, promise, last one.
Yes.
What is your most unexpected finding? What was the thing that you found where you just went, what on earth?
Oh, I think there were several.
Okay.
I think it was things like the cultural influence on things like the decision-making in Fantasia, the way that they assumed that the public would know the cultural references like the gangsters and the Dust Bowl. Yeah. And I think that that was quite a surprise that was so upfront, if you like. And I suppose to some extent I was surprised that doing my literature review that these questions hadn't really been considered in previous writing about this subject.
Well, Vicky, it's been great talking to you today. I'm sure listeners will have a new appreciation when they see dinosaurs on the big screen or the canvas. Is there anywhere that people can go to find out more about your research or just to learn more about Paleomedia? Any links you can suggest or like resources out there for them?
I think there is the one I'm personally involved in and started is the Paleomedia Project, the Bristol Paleomedia Project. It's a blog which is available online. It's started as an in-house thing in the university here, but with COVID went online as sessions, and we're going to keep those online so that we have discussions or I talk about an aspect like I have today. It's usually run on Zoom, so people can come in on that. There's a Twitter feed, Paleomedia, and there's a Instagram account, which isn't as lively as I'd like. And there's a Facebook group, which if you're interested, you would need to put in a request because I'm rather hoping to not engage some of the more extreme opponents. But it's become a project where other people are now contributing, you'll be pleased to hear. And we're hoping very much, and now with Suresh's help, we're hoping very much to sort of keep this going and get people involved. So possibly either search for the Paleomedia Project or perhaps we can put a link out online.
Indeed. We shall add some links to those groups and those pages in the description. And again, thank you for inviting me on to help you out with that as well. I think all that remains for me to say is thank you again, Vicky, for this fascinating chat. I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it and certainly learned a lot more about what goes into making these documentaries and paintings than they did beforehand. So thank you again, and thank you, listeners. Hope you enjoyed.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.